You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Tour de France, brought to you by iWoka, flexible loans built for small businesses, iwoka.co.uk. Today, we're in Nice.
Where are we, Lionel?
We're in Nice, Richard.
But a bit more specific than that, please.
Well, Francois, would it be fair to say that there's an Italian quarter in Nice? We're going to be eating in an Italian restaurant around the corner. Well, is there an Italian influence?
An Italian influence here? You mean, I mean, Nice is an Italian town.
Nice used to be a town in Italy.
Well, it's a little bit more complicated than this. It was actually a county, the county of Nice, and then it was including in various kingdoms, so the kingdoms of Sardinia, and then it was included in the kingdom of Savoy, you know, as well. So it was actually always on the verge of between France and Italy. It was disputed for a long time, and the dispute was settled in the late 19th century when Nice became French. But the local hero, I mean, it would take me hours to talk about this guy called Garibaldi, who was the champion of, you know, Italian independence.
Fantastic biscuits.
he was born and bred in Nice. He was a real Nissar, as they say. Nissar being, you know, the real hardcore Niçois. And Garibaldi's life is amazing. He was a Che Guevara of the late 19th century. He lived in London for quite a while, and he actually had apparently great lady fans in London when he lived there, and you know they were kind of attacking his hotel for, well, apparently not for signatures or autographs, but selfies in the day. I don't know about selfies.
Well, they took a while in those days.
Gary, Lionel's in.
Yeah, he didn't have lots of hair.
Lionel Baldy. Lionel's interest in this is obviously food related, and we are eating in an Italian restaurant. But we are just around the corner from the Promenade des Anglais, where today's stage finished, as did yesterday's stage, which has been unusual, hasn't it? Two stages of the Tour de France finishing in the same place, starting and finishing in the same place, Nice to Nice, on two consecutive days. That's been an interesting and novel start. And Promenade des Anglais yesterday, not such a spectacular backdrop, but today we saw the Côte d'Azur at its best, didn't we? It was stunningly blue.
It was incredibly blue. And just on blue and the House of Savoy and Italy, we had an email from a listener called Debbie last week just querying why the Italian national team wear blue. I think this came out because Giacomo Nizzolo won the European Road Race Championships up in Brittany last week. He's wearing the European champions jersey, isn't he? But why do the Italian national team wear blue? And I gather it's because it was the colour of the House of Savoy, which was the royal family under which Italy unified in 1861. There are some other theories, but let's get on with stage two of the Tour de France. As you say, Richard, starting and finishing in Nice, 186 kilometres, a very different course on the menu for the riders today, over the Col de la Colmiane, the Col de Turini, the Col d'Aise, and then finally over the little Col de Quatre Chemins, which is basically the same climb as the Col d'Aise, really, isn't it? It's sort of the same hillock. Out the back of Nice, isn't it? Well, after a fortnight in the race lead last year, Julian Alaphilippe is back in yellow tonight after winning the stage. Really thrilling three-up sprint finish between Alaphilippe, the young Sunweb rider Mark Hershey, and Britain's Adam Yates of Mitchelton Scott. The three of them got away on that final climb of the Col des Quatre Chemins, and there was a furious sprint at the top, wasn't there, which Adam Yates took the bonus time. The time bonus in that sprint, and
The guy I was watching that with said, "Oh, that was a bit of a pointless sprint, wasn't it?"
I'd completely forgotten that there was a super bonus time sprint. I mean, how many other people? It wouldn't have been Francois, would it? He wouldn't dismiss something as pointless. But yeah, it was only when you pointed out that there were seconds on the line there that I clocked on. Anyway, the sprint at the finish was interesting as well, wasn't it? Because Adam Yates was kind of lured into the wrong position. Julian Alaphilippe opened it up. And then Mark Hershey, a former under-23 world champion, of course, was coming up pretty fast. And had he not sort of taken a drink with 700 meters to go.
700 meters to go, which was unusual. And then he did set off quite a lot. He was in the perfect position. Alaphilippe launched pretty hard. And Hirschi came back quickly. And, you know, he just gave him too much of a gap. He was just sitting off a bit too much. But he is a young guy, 22 years old, only just turned 22, and clearly a huge talent.
Well, riding not only his first Tour de France, but his first Grand Tour, was on the podium with Remco Evenepoel at the San Sebastian Classic last year, of course. It was a finish that really suited Team Ineos and Jumbo-Visma, we were saying at the time, weren't we? Because it means that neither of them had to get involved in what might have been quite a messy sprint with a reasonable-sized group of GC riders going shoulder to shoulder on the Promenade des Anglais there. But it suited them to give De Koenig Quickstep the job of defending the yellow jersey for a few days. When the peloton woke up this morning in their respective bedrooms, probably around a quarter of them would have been checking to see how their ribs felt and their, you know, backs and their sides, and checking out their various wounds after such a damaging day for so many of them yesterday. We knew last night after we'd recorded that Philippe Gilbert is out of the race, having broken his kneecap. Rafa Valls of Bahrain, McLaren, who I think came in last yesterday, also out with a broken leg. And lots of other riders nursing wounds. Groupama FDJ with Thibaut Pinot, David Godu, William Bonnet and Rudy Mollard, all nursing injuries.
Godu was off the back early, wasn't he? And there was no...
there was no waiting
for him.
There wasn't. But David de la Cruz also has broken bones. Wout Poels with a broken rib. So a real tough day in the saddle for them with climbing right off the... there was a little bit of time to settle into the saddle, but the first big climb of the tour coming on day two made it an uncomfortable day for many, no doubt. The breakaway featured two Bora Hansgrohe riders, Peter Sagan and our audio diarist, Lucas Postelberger. Benoit Cosnefroy of AG2R was in there, Kasper Askelin of De Koenig Quickstep, Tom Skuins of Trek Segafredo, Anthony Perez of Cofidis and Michael Gergel of NTT Pro Cycling were the men in front. And although, as we always say, the gap wasn't huge at any point, but it was a break of convenience. Dangerous, but not too dangerous. They're actually caught at the foot of the Col d'Ez. And that's when we saw Nielsen Paulus, the American rider with EF Pro Cycling, attack. There was some strange crashes as well today, weren't there? We saw Leonard Kamner of Bora Hansgrohe go down on the uphill of the Col d'Ez. Nico Roach was first to the top. Just a little plug for tomorrow's Kilometre Zero, which is sort of loosely based around the Col d'Ez and the Irish domination there in the 1980s. So an Irishman getting to the top first. Then there was a crash for Danny Martinez, recent winner of the Dauphiné, on the descent, and he lost some time. Which is unfortunate for EF Pro Cycling. He did actually get back up to the peloton, or what remained of the peloton, but then when the power went on again on that final climb, he was in difficulty, so finished over 3.5 minutes down. There was another incident on that last climb. Tom Dumoulin was looking over his left shoulder and didn't see Mikhail Kwiatkowski of Ineos coming across the front of him, and Dumoulin went down. Kwiatkowski turned round and made quite an elaborate apologetic gesture, perhaps taking responsibility. That's a bit,
I think it was 50-50 in 50-50. Terms of responsibility there, because Kwiatkowski did cut across him quite dramatically.
But so Dumoulin wasn't facing the right way.
Not deliberately, I'm not saying that, but it was... It was an unfortunate collision.
And so it exploded on that final climb. Julian Alaphilippe attacked. Mark Hirschi was the surprise, really, coming out of the group to close up to Alaphilippe. And then Adam Yates went behind. We also saw Marc Soler of Movistar go clear briefly. As you guys joked at the time, the surest signal that his job today was to work for Alejandro Valverde.
Well, especially as Alejandro Valverde had a couple of mechanicals almost at the same time. So he was probably reined in by, you know, his ear system.
In his ear, yeah, exactly, getting some grief in the earpiece. As I said, Adam Yates won the critical, crucial time bonus sprint at the top of that final climb, and then we had the run into the finish. The losers from the GC riders today, really, Fabio Aru of UAE Team Emirates, over 2 minutes down. Martinez, as I mentioned, but Ilnur Zakarin and Warren Barguil both lost 4.5 minutes. Dan Martin, 17:45 down, and Wout Poels, perhaps not surprisingly, with a fractured rib, 25 minutes down. So Alaphilippe back in yellow. Alexander Kristoff, who was off the back really once they started the serious climb of the Turini. He now moves into the green jersey. Benoit Cosnefroy of AG2R, who we saw have a little dig at the when hostilities resumed yesterday, didn't we? He managed to snaffle the polka dot jersey, and Mark Hershey is in white. And tomorrow we leave Nice after our long weekend here, and we head up to Sisteron for what we expect will be a sprint.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWoka. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWoka. If you run a small business, find out more at iwoka.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
A French accented thank you to iWoka, our title sponsor. Very grateful indeed to them for their support. And if you run a small business or know somebody who does, have a look at iwoca.co.uk, iwoca.co.uk. Lots of information there about finance that you can get very easily with iWoka and by talking to actual people, which is unusual in this day and age. Well, listen, chaps, we've covered a bit of Nice history here. But a couple of relevant lines today, especially. He who has a why to live can bear almost any how. To live is to suffer. To survive is to find some meaning in the suffering. Nietzsche, who lived walked on the paths around the Col d'Ais.
Mm-hmm, wrote for T-Mobile.
Yeah, he was their philosopher in chief. And it's interesting, we heard last night from Michael Morkov about today's stage, about, you know, the anticipation of it being a real GC battle, and we'd see, and I think back to 92 in San Sebastian, and there was a very hilly stage on day two, and we saw the big guns come to the fore, and some people fancied we'd see some kind of shootout between Roglic and Bernal and Dumoulin and these guys. It wasn't that, and I think part of the reason for that is we're so early in the race. It's a different sport now, really, where teams are much stronger. But also, I think after yesterday, there was a sort of lull and probably a hope to get through today without too many incidents. I mean, the descent of the Turini was very dangerous, wasn't it? And so I'm not saying there was a truce called, but the racing didn't really spark into life until that final climb and Alaphilippe's attack.
And when you look at how the race organisers have to put the course together, and that's the job of Thierry Gouvenou and the team, if you wanted a real GC shootout on day two, it can go one of two ways, couldn't it? You don't really want to rule out, you know, six or seven of the GC riders on the opening weekend. And you could argue also that if you had the Col de Turini at the end of the stage and forced people to really race down that descent into Nice, it would have been too much. So it's all about finding the balance between what you want the race to do over 3 weeks, what you want from any given day, and what is sensible and safe for the riders. And I think after yesterday, there probably wouldn't have been too much appetite for risk-taking because so many people hit the deck.
Yeah, on Grand Tours and especially on the Tour, as we found recently, usually if you have five climbs, and even if the last climb is a second cut climb, that's where the actual action takes place. And today maybe Dumoulin's crash was a factor, you know, because Team Jumbo-Visma were leading the way, you know, safely at that stage, and then Dumoulin had this this problem with Kwiatkowski. Josh Bennett was leading the field. He looked back quite a few times to see whether Dumoulin was doing all right or not, and then they stopped chasing. That's when Quickstep took over and launched literally Julien Alaphilippe towards victory. I mean, Alaphilippe's victory, let's face it, his first win in since the Tour last year, actually. He had not won a single race since the time trial in Pau He lost his father in June, so as you might have seen on TV, he kind of collapsed, you know, on the finish line and in tears, thinking about his father. To be honest, I think it was the ideal scenario for everybody involved. I mean, I talked to a few, even if it's difficult to get to the riders and the DSs on this Tour de France, as we kind of managed, and we'll probably get back to it one day on how we work on this strange Tour de France. But everybody was telling me that really nobody really wants to take the yellow jersey on day two. I mean, the teams, you know, looking for final victory, it would have been an embarrassment in many ways to take the yellow jersey so early. So for Alaphilippe, you know, French local hero, the hero of the latest edition of the Tour, which kind of brings back the Tour to normal life, like there's no COVID, like there's no crisis, that we're back to the last year's Tour de France. It's great for Quickstep. Know how to, it was the 41st victory by Quickstep in its various, you know, appellations
in the
Tour of France. Yeah. So it's like, you know, once again it's like business as usual. Jumbo Visma have not tried very hard to win this stage. Ineos Grenadiers, we saw them a little bit at the front for a while. Well, when Jumbo Visma decided to take it a little bit more easy. And
once Fiakowski got rid of Demuller.
Absolutely.
Joking.
And in the end that's great for the Tour, it's great for the organizers, it's great for the fans. You know, Julien is back in yellow, and now, you know, the Tour can start for real.
Just on the Ineos Grenadiers, I mean, they were on the front on the descent of the final climb back down into Nice, but it looked to me like they were just controlling and leading the way rather than chasing completely. I mean, they were just, you know, they were perfectly happy with the situation out front, and no one else wanted to come back round them. And
I think it's funny because the Demuller tumble did take the wind out of Jumbo-Visma's sails a little bit, and the guy who stopped to help him was Wout van Aert, who could have won today's stage.
Right.
I suggested that he might be contender for today yesterday, and I was told that it was too tough a stage, but there was Greg Van Avermaet winning the sprint for fourth. So, I Van Aert certainly could have won today's stage, but there were a couple of things that suggested that that wasn't in the front of his mind. One was that he was on bottle duty, and not just picking up one or two bottles. I've never seen so many bottles stuffed down a jersey. If he had in the back of his mind the possibility of winning stage three, I don't think he'd have been doing that. And also the fact that he so quickly and almost instinctively stopped to help Demoulin also sort of confirmed that he's here for one job and one job only, which is amazing, really, for a rider of that ability and in that kind of form. You know, with the form that he is in, he could have been contending yesterday. He was scared to sprint yesterday, he said, and he could have been contending. He could have actually won the first two stages.
It could be a contender tomorrow. I think the problem is that Jumbo-Visma or Ineos Grenadiers or other teams with the GC ambitions, nobody really wants to the burden of the yellow jersey as early in the, and to have Quickstep, you know, such a strong team, with the yellow jersey, it actually, you know, suits everybody. That's the ideal scenario for most teams.
And yet, there was a sense, we were talking about the 2019 Tour and how when we saw how it played out in the final two mountain stages in the Alps, how other teams must have been kicking themselves for missed opportunities early in the race. And yet we see potentially the same sort of scenario today. I mean, no one else really has tried to make too many gains today. Not that I'm not really suggesting that anyone could necessarily have made some gains, but yeah, having a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush, as they say. You know, having the yellow jersey.
Who up there? There were a few names that caught my eye. Tadej Pogacar, you know, has had 2 days where he's been riding well enough. He was up there in the sprint yesterday. He was eighth on the stage today. He had a problem today. He had to have a bike change. I think he punctured on the descent of the Torini, didn't he? Obviously, he's going extremely well. I was surprised and pleased to see Max Schachmann, ninth. He had that terrible crash when he was hit by a car a couple of weeks ago in Lombardy. Well, he apparently broke his collarbone, so he's riding with a broken collarbone, apparently. But he was ninth today, which is great to see. Guillaume Martin, 11th. And then, you know, the others all sort of clustered together, really, not wasting anything at the moment. And Thibaut Pinot, who looked pretty defeated at the end of yesterday's stage, came through today okay. And you spoke, you were trying to get to his DS yesterday, Francois. He finally got back to you last night, didn't he?
Yeah, as I said on the podcast last night, you know, I was surprised that Philippe Moyes, a good friend, was not, you know, coming back to me about Thibaut Pinot. He actually called me at midnight.
Wow.
We were back from our Indian curry meal.
So we need to talk about that at some point, don't we?
And he called me at midnight, and I said, well, you know, it's, I mean, tell me what you have to tell me, but, you know, we can't obviously put it on the podcast. But and so we talked quite a bit this morning. Well, he actually told me that you might have seen the pictures of Pino on the finish line last night, looking miserable and looking kind of dejected and maybe depressed. He didn't look the same at all this morning. And Maudit told me that he was actually really frustrated. And I learned from Maudit and another DS is that there's been a real inner struggle in in yesterday's stage between DSs and riders and the team, you know, the tour direction, Thierry Gouvenou. Apparently, texts were sent to commissaires, texts were sent to the organizers for the race to be neutralized, or at least to make it clear as quickly as possible that the 3K rule would apply. And apparently, there was a little bit of a dispute there between you know, some of the guys. And so, well, if I can go a little bit more deeply into that, how could I put it? I mean, so, some of the texts were pretty intense. Brutal. I mean, so yesterday when we saw, you know, Martin all of a sudden, you know, asking everybody to calm down, behind the scenes, that there had been a lot of texting and phoning and everything, and there you are. You
so they wanted ASO to actually officially neutralize the stage.
Yeah, and in the end, the riders took over.
I think
that
would only have really been an issue if there had been a breakaway up the road. I mean, one of our audio diarists, Michael Morkov, sent in a really interesting, lengthy dispatch last night that you'll hear in an episode of Kilometre Zero coming up. He talked a little bit about this and said that it was easy for the riders themselves to neutralize the stage because there was no breakaway up the road.
Exactly.
If there'd been a breakaway up the road, there would have been a different scenario, and, you know, persuading those guys in the break to neutralize stage would have been quite tough. It's a bit like in a few years ago, was it 2010, when Fabian Cancellara effectively neutralized
Spa. In Spa, exactly.
And
Sylvain
Chavanel was away, wasn't he? And he won the stage and took the yellow jersey as well, I think. But anyway, there were various rumours as well today or last night about what caused all the crashes yesterday. Olive oil on the road, olives falling, olive oil.
It was Matt Wise's theory, because I talked to Matt Wise as well this morning, and that's what he was saying as well. Mm. That all been told that it's frequent in this season that, you know, olives fall from the olive trees at the time of the season because that's a crop for olive oil. And apparently, there might have been olive oil on top of everything else, you know?
Or there was one theory that the publicity caravan was dispensing soap.
Well, yeah.
And another vehicle in the publicity caravan dispensing banana skins.
Well, I mean, one of the sponsors in the publicity caravan is a washing soap, washing powder or washing liquid manufacturer, and that was one of the rumours. But we understand that the publicity caravan didn't go down the descent, over and down the descent of that climb. So, you know, that probably not the explanation. I think that's been debunked.
And to finish on this controversy, which was yesterday's story, I talked to Thierry Gouvenou this morning, who said, well, the reason why we didn't neutralize the race was that, you know, the last 30 k's of the stage were pretty, I mean, there was no real danger on those last 30 k's, and we didn't want to if we had neutralized the race, then we would have been accused of, you know, of preventing a bunch sprint and finish. And so he said, well, at the time when we were asked to do that, we told them, just wait a bit, be careful, and as soon as we get to the bottom of the descent, there won't be any issue anymore. So,
chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast, team car at the back of the pack, please.
Our Tour de France coverage this year is sponsored by the next generation Watt bike Atom.
And today we're going to hear from a rider who has gone from strength to strength using the Watt bike Atom, not Lionel Burney. His name is Daniel Ward.
So my background in cycling is mainly weight loss related. So I started cycling to lose some weight. I was sick of getting injured through running, so I picked up the bike. And then more specifically with the Watt bike, I started training indoors because I was a retained firefighter at the time, so I had to spend a lot of time on call. So the Watt bike was a great solution for me to be able to make fitness gains while staying at home as well. Since then, I've gone on to become a competitive cyclist. So I ride with my local club. I've done a few races, compete in triathlons and that sort of thing, really. The thing that caught my eye about the Watt bike was that there was no real frills. It looked like quite a straightforward product. It had good reviews. And for me, it just looked like a sturdy, reliable product to use. And it's certainly been the case. I've had it over 2 years now, and it's not skipped a beat. With the Watt bike, it is just there. You turn it on and jump on. That is it. There's no setup. There's no like other putting a bike on something or fiddling around. It's just a case of getting on it. Done long endurance ride indoors, a lot of like short higher intensity stuff. I'll very often use erg mode to structure a session so that I don't have to think about changing gear. Struggle when your heart rate is quite high to process some thoughts. So just being able to sit there and pedal, knowing that the Watt bike's changing the resistance so you can get the maximum training benefit is a big, big plus.
So if the versatility of the Watt bike Atom is something that appeals to you, you'll be very pleased to know it's available now from £90 per month. See wattbike.com, that's wattbike.com for details. And we'll be hearing more from Daniel tomorrow.
The Cycling Podcast, Audio Diaries. Sam Bewley, Michelton Scott.
Hey guys, Sam Bewley checking in after two stages of the Tour de France. She's been a pretty wild couple of days actually. Obviously yesterday was nothing short of an ice skating rink out there. Most of our team came through it all right. We had a couple of guys crash with Imps and Frosty, Mikel Nieve. Both those guys were okay though and back on the tools today. So we were pretty lucky in that sense. It was a pretty crazy stage. The peloton did their best to we neutralised the final descent, which was a great initiative by the guys and a real show of solidarity within the peloton, which was great to see and really an intelligent move actually. That descent would have been pretty tricky in the wet. And then as soon as we got to the bottom, we were all go again and hopefully gave you guys an exciting finish to see. Unfortunately, there was a big crash there with 3K to go, but still managed to see a good sprint there from Christoph, and quite cool to see him take the yellow jersey, actually. He's been close a number of times in Tour de France to taking the yellow, and really cool to see him put the yellow jersey on today. Obviously, we went straight into the mountains, stage two, which is very rare at the Tour de France. It's not so rare at the Giro or the Vuelta, but quite rare here at the Tour de France, so made for a very tough day. Well, what can I say, really? We had the plan to have a crack at the stage one, absolutely, and Adam went very close today with third place. Unfortunately, he was there with Alaphilippe, who was going to be pretty hard to wrap up in the sprint, but he did an awesome ride, and that was the plan all day, was to try to set him up. Basically, my job today was just looking after him until we got to the climbs and then sort of bit of stage management. It was a long, long way to go, and I'll be required on a couple of other stages or a number of other stages going forward. So wasn't feeling super sharp today, so I sort of went into stage management a bit and just made sure I got through the best I could so we can have a crack in the days to come. So far, it's been a good start for us. We're obviously here to win some stages, and we went close already, only 2 days in. So let's see what happens tomorrow. Could be a sprint stage. There's not a lot of opportunities here at the Tour, so I think those sprint teams will be quite keen to try to dictate terms a little bit tomorrow and make that happen. But there's also a chance the breakaway could win. It's not a super easy stage. Pretty lumpy through the middle part there, so should be another exciting stage for you guys to watch. All good at my end, getting through Game of Thrones. Yep, all things going well at the moment. So hope you guys are enjoying the Tour so far, and plenty more excitement to come.
Well, that was another of our diarists, Sam Bewley of Michelton Scott, a Tour debutant. He mentioned Game of Thrones there. He's been working his way through Game of Thrones. The first reference to that you'll hear in the episode of Kilometre Zero coming out later this week, which will feature all our diarists. And we'll hear a bit more from them about the whole build-up to the Tour and how the first few days have gone. And we'll obviously hear from them throughout our coverage of the Tour de France. Kilometre Zero starts tomorrow, Monday. Monday to Friday, every morning, there's an episode of Kilometre Zero supported by Zwift. First time we've had an association with Zwift, so that's very pleasing indeed. We've all been using a lot of Zwift over the last few months, haven't we? And we're very grateful to them for supporting our Kilometre Zero series. So, listen, chaps. Sam Bewley, a teammate, of course, of Adam Yates, who did a good ride today. I mean, they've come here looking for stages. It was a good finish for him. You know, he hasn't been super convincing since racing resumed, but clearly in good shape because, you know, to make the effort to go with Alaphilippe and Hirschi over the top of the climb there shows that he's going well. He rode pretty well. I think you spoke to Matt White this morning, didn't you, Francois? You were tipped off at this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was very odd because, as you know, we're forced. You've probably seen pictures of it already, either on TV or on other sites, on websites. We're working in strange condition with a mixed zone with boxes and stuff. And actually, I was walking down the road, and then I kind of bumped into Matt White, who told me about, you know, prospects for the day. I'd kind of forgotten about Adam Yates, but he pointed out, you know, today is a stage for Adam, I kind of knew before it happened that the card they were going to play was Adam Yates. Probably the fact that they had such a hot stage on day two, it was a bit of a problem for most teams because remember last year Simon Yates, so you know Adam's twin brother, had taken advantage of the course to lose time in the early stages to have freedom to go for stage wins, which was not really the case today for Adam Yates. But Adam Yates tried his best, you know. He was not far from it. Let's face it, in the finale, we had three teams with the same ambitions in the Tour de France. Three teams who'd announced before the Tour started they were going for stage wins. And let's face it, you have Julian Alaphilippe, Adam Yates, and Hirschi in a sprint finish. Most of the time, you'd get the same results. I think Alaphilippe is probably the most experienced and probably the fastest of the three. So good try for Mitchelton Scott. I guess they're probably the most disappointed team of the day. Everything went almost according to plan, but not quite.
But doesn't it put them in the picture for the rest of this week? Because there's a finish at Orsières-Melette on Tuesday, and then there's a finish at Mont-Aigoual in the Cévennes on Thursday. That's going to be Alaphilippe versus Adam Yates with everyone else kind of, you know, I mean, the time gaps are so small. It's not like last year where Alaphilippe won so convincingly on the night that we had all that champagne at Laurent Perrier. I mean, just remember, they're the two things I remember from that day, understandably. But Alaphilippe was much more convincingly in yellow last year, whereas this year, it's tenuous. It's, you know, a couple of handfuls of seconds still splits everyone. So
it's going to be exciting in terms of stage wins, but as well, you know, bearing in mind that probably neither Ineos or Jumbo-Visma will be looking for the yellow jersey as early in the tour, there might be a swap of stage wins and a swap of yellow jerseys along the way. For Mitchelton Scott, I mean, you know, winning stages was the plan. But once again, these kind of teams, Quickstep or Mitchelton Scott, are the ideal teams for the GC contenders to leave the yellow jersey to. So, you know, there'll be more at stake in the upcoming days than just stage wins. I mean, the yellow jersey could change hands along the way. It's funny, Adam Yates, we all know he's leaving the team at the end of the season. I keep wondering all the time how a team, how hard is the team working for a guy who's leaving at the end of the season. So same applies to Bardet. I was talking to guys from AG2R this morning and kind of idolized this guy with AG2R in the past. And this morning, like they're already counting him out of their plans. It's a strange one. So we'll see. But yeah, Adam Yates could be one of the, with Alaphilippe, I think that they're probably the two guys we're going to see more and more in the next couple of days.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
thank you very much to Science and Sport for their support of the cycling podcast. We were fueled by Science and Sport on our ride today, weren't we, Lionel?
Well, you were. I forgot my Science and Sport.
Well, I tried to give you a Science and Sport product, but you were being very very sensible.
Well,
you'd
already touched it, and I was reluctant to just in case. But I suffered on the climbs as a result. I would have liked a little boost of something as we were going up the Col de Vence.
Well, I enjoyed my energy bake. And you can get 25% off your Science and Sport products with the code SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. SISCP25. Stephen Moon, our friend at Science and Sport, Chief Executive, got in touch today, actually, and they, Science and Sport, are supporting the Flames Cycling Club in Sierra Leone. They've sent them a whole load of new sports nutrition products, but the club out there are looking for inner tubes and tyres and things. They're fixing punctures with rope due to lack of inner tubes. If anybody out there has access to inner tubes or tyres or anything, would like to support the Flames Cycling Club in Sierra Leone, drop us an email, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com.
Le vin du jour, à votre santé.
I mean, this is extraordinary, Richard. You've bought wine glasses.
Cheers.
As well.
Cheers, fellas.
What are we having? What are we enjoying?
It is Provence Rosé by Williams Chase. William Chase is a British entrepreneur. He started Tyrrell's Crisps, Lionel.
Really? And you've bought some crisps. Have you bought Tyrrell's? No.
No, I haven't. So this is from Divine Cellars, who have done our Tour de France wine. They did our Giro wine. Greg from Divine Cellars sent us notes for each wine. What do you think, Francois? You're a man of Provence.
First of all, I think I have to give you a little lesson on how to taste the wine, because, I mean, you served glasses and Lionel, you know, quickly put the beverage in his mouth and that's it. Well, that's not the way.
That's how we drink.
You know, so first you look at the wine, you say, oh my God, what a great color, you know. And so you look at the color. So for rosé, it is pretty clear, you know. Some rosé are more, you know, virgin on the red than this one. So it's bound to be very light and fruity, probably.
Almost a golden color, Francois.
Yeah, well, gold, well, just a little, you know, pinkish touch, you know, shade you need for rosé. Then once you've looked at the wine, you smell it. It smells of grapes, you know. Well, it does, but it also smells of, yeah, it's very acid, but that's rosé most of the time are, you know, pretty acid. But it also tastes already a little bit of grapefruit, I think. So that's probably the taste he's going to have. And now, after you've done that, you put the beverage into your mouth. And, as I said, pretty grapefruity, yeah. Because rosé, especially in Provence, very often they taste of orange or you know, lemon, or and very often grapefruit. So that's the case. So yeah, it's pretty good Côte de Provence. I mean, it's my area. I've drank probably hundreds of bottles of those of this, you know, Provence rosé. So it's okay. It's okay. Good stuff.
Hundreds of bottles of rosé, what, a month or a week? Or
we had rosé last night, actually. It's a lovely summer drink, isn't it?
It is.
You wouldn't drink it in the winter.
It is. It's got a bad name for, you know, lots of wine lovers. Like, this is not wine, you know. Wine is red or white. And actually, if that's the way you think, just take it as a summer drink and you realize it's quite a very good summer drink. And some roses are, you know, in the summer, well, almost as good as a good beer, or probably better in my opinion. So, no, this is a nice little drink. It's well done. It's very well balanced, I think. A little bit bitter, maybe. So some guys might like, you know, like their rosé a little bit fruitier than this. But no, it's good stuff. It's good stuff.
Well, I think it's very nice. Well, chaps, that was our wine of the day. We'll not be doing a wine every day, but we've got some wine with us. And if you'd like to purchase a cycling podcast collection of wine, go to divinecellars.com. Information in the episode notes as well. Did Bernardino just walk past us?
No, it was Pascalino.
Heard Bernardino.
No, we're talking of, you know, kind of ephemeris French yellow jersey holders. Yeah, it was Pascalino who just came past.
Pascalino held the yellow jersey in 1992, which we were talking about a little bit earlier, weren't we? He was... Who got it first? Did Virant get it first and then he got it? I can't remember.
No, I don't think Virant got it first.
It wasn't Virant, RMO. Yeah. It was another RMO rider took the jersey, and then Lino, I think. Mm. But we'd have to... I think so.
I think Lino, kept it for quite a while, actually.
Well, champs, I'd just like to correct you there, because Richard Virant did take the yellow jersey in 1992 for one day after Stage 2, which were won by Javier Mergualdi. They went from San Sebastian, the prologue was won by Miguel Indurain, straight into the Pyrenees. So, but this tour is probably the most mountainous early stage
since
92, which is why we talked about it a little bit earlier. And then Pascalino got the jersey for what, ten days before Indurain took it and won the tour.
Yeah, he was a very stylish rider, wasn't he, Lino? Limbs, and he looked good.
Yeah, good guy. He's still very fit, you know, 30 years later, almost. Mm. I don't know if he still rides his bike, but he works for ASO now. He drives one of the direction cars.
Well, listen, chaps, the other guy who deserves a mention today is Mark Hershey, 22 years old, and I guess there are two things here. I made the controversial claim on the podcast recently that Alaphilippe was not quite the rider this year that he was last year. I stand by that. You know, the fact that Hershey, obviously a very good rider, but the fact he was able to bridge across to Alaphilippe, I don't think he'd have been able to do that last year, not just because he was only 21 last year, having just turned 21. Anyway, I'm getting into a tangent here. Mark Hershey, clearly a very talented rider. He won the World Under 23 Road Race in Innsbruck in 2018, overshadowed maybe by Remco Evenepoel, who won the Junior Road Race that same year. But Hershey is, in any other time, a 22-year-old rider, or indeed a 21-year-old rider last year who got a podium place at San Sebastian, would be a hugely exciting prospect who we'd all be talking about. But of course, he's one of many young riders really performing at this level, but he's a good one, and he's a kind of archetypal Sunweb rider now. You know, they're not the team that they were built around Tom Dumoulin. They're a team now of opportunists. They're good at developing riders, and there are quite a few riders in that same mould who can hunt for stages, and today was an excellent performance by Hershey, and he came very close to winning.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing, you know. I've never seen it. I mean, you know, in my decades in the sport, so many young up and coming talent coming every year. You seem to have another guy, and in every kind of cycling profile, like GC contenders like Pogacar or Bernal, of course, or even, you know, kind of more classics type of riders. There seems to be one, two, three of them coming up every year, and Hershey is one of these guys. And that's really exciting to see. Sunweb, as you say, well, it's funny that they managed to do without Michael Matthews, who just won Plouay, which is, you know, in the same time odd, but we can understand why, with such a tight schedule until the end of the season. And but with Bardet, next year you have Romain Bardet, they'll have Michael Matthews, hopefully, again, and all these up-and-coming riders, since the days of Skill Shimano, they've been always very, very good to kind of, you know, foster and nurture riders into maturity. And Hershey, really an exciting young rider. It was nice to see today.
Well, when we saw Tish Benoot get dropped relatively early on, and on a day when you would think, I mean, if this was a Paris-Nice stage, you would think, well, Benoot would be up there. And to see him, get dropped was surprising. Nico Roach, as we said, went over the Col d'Ez first. But the omission of Michael Matthews really surprised me when I looked at the roster and what the rest of the season holds. And Matthews is in that same bracket as Wout van Aert in a way. He could have won yesterday, could have won today. And so for Hershey to come out, it does sort of prove a bit of a point. Maybe, you know, Sunweb obviously know more about their roster of riders than I do. As we were editing tonight's episode, Team Sunweb put out a statement on social media to explain that Michael Matthews would be allowed to leave the team at the end of 2020, despite having a contract for 2021, which does answer the question as to why Matthews isn't here at the Tour de France.
Well, Matt Winston, their coach, spoke at the finish about the plan today, and it was for Hershey to go for the stage win. He paid quite a tribute, as did Hershey himself, to Nicholas Roach for the work that he did in trying to set him up. So, you know, they clearly know what their riders are capable of. And maybe with someone like Matthews, there would be a danger that the team would be, you know, having to support him. I know that when I spoke to Luke Roberts last year about the prospect of Tom Dumoulin leaving, I got the real sense that there was a feeling of relief that they would no longer have to devote so many resources to this goal of trying to win Grand Tours with one rider. You know, all your eggs in one basket. What they want are lots of eggs in lots of baskets. And that's the team that they brought to the Tour here. Soren Kram Andersen as well, another guy who might have been up there today. But, you know, they brought a team of guys who can target different stages, and I think Benoot might not be fully fit, but he may be somebody who's targeting a stage in a couple of days.
Well, let's hear from one of our diarists, Nikias Arndt, on Mark Hershey, his young teammate.
Hey guys, it's Nikias, and the second stage is in the pocket. Really nice day for us. Mark Hershey finished second today after a really strong race. He raced really smart. We had some contact before approaching Col d'Ais, so on Col de Turini I was still talking to him and making a little bit the plan how we approach a final, and I never expected that he will approach it or that he will execute it that good, and I'm really proud on him, and that was really a nice day. On top of second place today, we also get the white jersey tomorrow, which is for the whole team, I think, a really, really nice thing. But I think just as a person, Mark is a real racer. Off the bike, he's actually quite calm and also sometimes a little bit insecure about a few things, but on the bike he's just a racer, and I think that we could really see today in the stage. And yeah, as a road captain, it was also nice to be part of it and support him a little bit in the race, make a good plan. But that he can finish it off like that is something special, and I'm really proud on the teamwork today, but also on Hershey himself. And I think we are looking forward to next stages, and curious what is coming. And me personally, after my crash, I'm okay. It could be worse. I have a lot of wounds, but all of them are not too big. So I think in a few days I will be also really okay again. Then we see how it goes.
Well, listen, chaps, we should wrap things up for tonight, stage two of the 2020 Tour de France. We leave Nice tomorrow. I think we'll be, much as I love Nice, and I really do like Nice, I think I'll be glad to get out of the city. Cities don't feel like the best places to be at the moment. There are reminders everywhere of what's going on in the world. People in masks, just lots of people, really.
Mm.
And we're heading out of the city tomorrow, and I think that'll be good, and I think the Tour will sort of breathe a sigh of relief as well, that the first couple of days have been done, and okay, there's been controversy, there have been crashes, but to tick them off will be quite a relief, I would imagine.
Yeah, we won't be obliged by, you know, legally to wear a mask in Sisteron. Well, we will, because we're cautious and we're good guys, and we're aware that there's still a pandemic going on. But yeah, I mean, we're going out of one of the red zones in France too, and as we know from, you know, past tours, the Tour on really gets going when it's moving. It's a moving circus, and it's not a circuit race. And it's been a circus race for 2 days. Exciting, exciting stages, but we might start to get the real feel of the Tour de France when we get moving.
Well, should we give the final word to Michael Mercou of De Koninck Quickstep? His teammate Julian Alaphilippe is in yellow tonight, of course, and tomorrow with an expected sprint finish, although not a comfortable ride to Sisteron. It will be up and down all day. It's a lumpy one, but one that should suit Sam Bennett, the Irishman on De Koninck Quickstep, looking for his first Tour de France stage win, of course, having won in both the Giro and the Vuelta.
Three in the Giro, two in the Vuelta, I think.
Well done. Yes, of course. Yeah, of course. I was there last year when Bennett had the stage win and Nico Roach had the red jersey. I mean, you know, and as
not
a
very good Irishman, are you?
terrible Irishman.
Passport's still on some probation.
quiet now.
It's been revoked after your performance on the Col d'Huez.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, if anyone were to look at my Strava data, I'd be denounced immediately. Anyway, Mercou will have the job along with his teammates of not only defending the yellow jersey, but trying to set up Sam Bennett for the sprint. And well, we wondered whether those two goals are aligned, and so this is Morkov talking about defending the yellow jersey and setting up Sam Bennett for the sprint, and he's talking to us live from the massage table.
We walked the inside track from our diarist, didn't we? We weren't quite expecting this, but anyway.
Semi-naked updates.
So now I'm having massage after a long day on the bike, a very hard second stage. It's not usual we have such a hard stage already in the first days of a big tour, but this was a proper mountain stage. It was a stage that Julian, he already looked out before, that it was a good stage for him. And obviously, we tried to set him up as best as possible for today. He succeeded and won a very beautiful stage. Took also yellow jersey, which we are very proud of in the team. Tour de France stage victories and yellow jerseys never anything you should take for granted. It's huge when you receive results like that. So we are very proud and we are looking very much forward to celebrate Julian when he comes back to the hotel later. So tomorrow we will obviously have to defend now a yellow jersey, and we are well prepared for that. We have a very strong team, and also tomorrow we hope we can go into the sprint again with Sam. I think there's a good chance for taking another stage win tomorrow. Sam is looking strong. Myself feels good coming into the sprints, and we have a good team. So actually having the yellow jersey is not really a disadvantage, because we'll have to control the race anyway, and we want to make sure that we can end up in a bunch sprint tomorrow. So now we're just very happy to get this stage win and yellow jersey, and now we will enjoy tomorrow and hopefully go for another victory.